It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
I am all confused in terms of our time coupling podcast zones and where we're at. Dude, this is a crazy summer.
Well, I guess our travel hasn't worked out too well because we're in the middle of July. We're recording podcasts deep into August. Like we said last
Time. I feel like I've gotten ahead of myself.
That kind of mitigates being able to bring in a lot of conversation from some of the recent podcasts, but it's just the way it's working out this summer.
Well, I'll use my alter personality, see if I can't come up with some conversation.
And then in August, we might have to do it because I'm off to Australia at the end of August, so we've got a couple weeks
off. Dude, you're hobnobbing the continents. What's your deal?
Oh, boy, I tell you, it's so hard to get on that international flight. But, yeah, just some things have worked out in Australia. One little town in Queensland has been deeply impacted by He Loves Me, and they wanted me to come out and spend some time with them. And I just thought, man, I really feel like that'd be a good thing to do. And with that, I'm going to stop in Adelaide and Sydney and Brisbane and have some time with a whole lot of different folks. So
sweet.
So, yeah, after being in Europe and then going the other direction and gosh, it's weird. You leave here Tuesday night, and you get there Thursday morning. And then you leave there the 2 weeks later on Tuesday afternoon, and you get here Tuesday morning. That Dateline thing, it's really confusing. I actually
get good things everything happens on Tuesdays.
That's a good fly day, actually. That's why it happened on Tuesday.
You're completely leaving out Asia. So what's up with that?
Leaving it out?
Well, you go to UK, you go to Europe, you've been in Africa, and then you go to Australia. You're leaving out the UK. No, you're leaving out.
Can't keep it straight, can you?
It's no.
Tough. Asia. I've been to Asia a number of times, but there's nothing coming there. You know, I've been invited in a while, so I don't go where I'm not invited. It always takes an invitation. I don't just sit here and go, I think I'll go visit Japan and see what's going on.
No? You don't just spin your globe and go, Ollie, out, Luke, Jesus, are we going there?
I would if he said that. I just not the way it works for me. I mean, if he did say, you know, I want you to go to Japan, hang out for a couple weeks, I would. But I don't, you know, usually my travel starts with somebody saying, hey, it's on our heart for you to come hang out with us.
So how do you chase down the things that you give your life to? In terms of, you know, most people wake up in the morning, they got a job. You don't have a normal job. You kind of just do whatever.
No, I wake up with 15 screaming monkeys asking for my attention on various things. So
I missed those this morning. It was the quiet. Monkeys? Yeah, I missed you. You must have pacified them.
They're up early.
Okay,
and they're bugging you. And you go, okay, am I going to write this? Am I going to plan this travel? Am I going to do a blog? Do You know, and there's just 15 of them.
You don't have a whole lot of structure to be the guide of, you know, just routine. So how do you figure out, you know, what am I going to give myself to? Is that a conversation? Is that a slow burn? What is
slow burn?
As far as, you know, coming to a place of, you know, understanding of what you're going to give yourself to. How do you do that? I imagine a lot of people wonder.
Yeah, they might. I probably wonder too, because I don't know that I've solved that any more than I wake up on a day, and by the time I get in here and have some time with Jesus and some of that, then there's usually something on my heart that inspires me, and I kind of follow that. So if it's working on, I've got 9 books in various stages of working right now, so that's 9 of the 15 monkeys, and you know, I just sense I've got some thoughts about this, so I just start writing those. Sometimes I start writing up the thoughts, and I don't even know where they're going to go yet. And then I go, okay, where would this best fit? And whether it's a blog or an article in Body Life or a book, or you know, so it's really an inexact science. It's just really a sensing in my heart and a following.
Vapor trails of inspiration.
Yeah, and if I get, you know, half hour into working on something I was so inspired about and the inspiration is gone, then I start, okay, well, what else is out there?
Right.
And so, I mean, there's so much that inspires me that it's not ever difficult for me to find something to do. It's harder to focus on something to be fruitful because there's 15 things I'd like to be playing with at the moment. My monkeys. There's 15 monkeys I'd like to play with.
But do you have a big game plan? Do you have a little game plan? Do you kind of diss that? Do you like that? Where are you at in the whole kind of what is God's plan for me?
Oh, for me personally?
Well, I mean, I'm talking you as how you live your life, and a question that I know oftentimes plagues a lot of people in terms of they're trying to figure out what to give themselves to. Some people are in the tyranny of the urgent where they're living from crisis to crisis trying to just figure life out.
Yeah.
That's no fun. It's rarely fruitful, and it's hard for them to get out. So in taking a step back, when you try to figure out, you know, like, what am I for? What am I supposed to be giving myself to? I think a lot of people ask that question. I don't know that a lot of people know how to answer that.
Yeah, and I don't know how I answer it for me, so I'm pretty sure I don't know how to answer it for them.
Okay.
Because I used to have a master plan, things I wanted to do, or I would, you know, outline, I'm going to write these books in this order, and I'm just going to grind my way through it. What I used to do all that, and I don't do any of that anymore, because I've really found it far more fruitful to live in the inspiration that I have, and even if and that even includes if I don't have any. If I don't have any, there's lots of busy work to do to catch up on business related issues in my life. So, when there's no inspiration to do other things, then it falls to the responsibilities that are mine on any given day. And sometimes, I mean, it looks like I don't, because I don't have a job I go to necessarily, but there are days where the tyranny of the urgent rules my life. There just are. I've got no choice. This I have to do today to satisfy somebody screaming for something that's a legitimate scream. It has to be dealt with. And so there are many days where that's just true as well. So, but I don't have a strategy anymore. I really feel like more and more I've come back to just living in the day. So God, what's before me today? What's next? And, you know, I do have a sense of the books that I'm, the nine books I'm writing. I do have a priority list in my head as to what direction I think those will get done. And so I kind of keep that in mind as I'm working on the inspiration of the day.
Well, would you say you have an overall sense of, you know, I am meant to be a communicator? Would you have a grand sense of that's where I'm given, you know, I'm wanting to travel the world to help people sort out their life in Jesus?
Yeah, I don't want to travel the world. That's that's the thing.
Well, everybody do quite a bit, so that's a little odd.
I do, yeah. I don't like it. I don't sit there and go, ooh, where can I go next? I go, oh, gosh, do I need to go? It really is a conversation about God saying, I'd like to share you here. It's not, if I spent every night of my life at home with Sarah, I'd be a great world. I'd be a great life. So I don't hate traveling. The traveling part's no fun anymore, but I don't mind. I love meeting new people. I love hanging out and having the conversations that.
So you're just waiting to get translated. You don't like the going, you like the being there.
If we get that Star Trek beam thing going, yeah, where you could just show up somewhere and then come home at night. That'd be great. I'd come home and be with Sarah in the evening. That'd be fabulous. But no, some of that. But I read stuff. I mean, I'm reading some of these history things where, you know, people go on a trip and it's, you know, 3 weeks to get to the United States on a ship. And so I'm going, okay, well, man, that would be very.
At least this has been improved.
Oh, this would seem like translation to them. What, you get on a plane and 10 hours later you crawl out in England? That's unbelievable. So it is. But, so you soccer nut, you suck me into the whole soccer thing and.
I didn't do anything to you. Did you watch on your own? Is that what you're saying?
I watched the final, and I thought it was stupid. Like I heard a guy say this week, seriously. He said, it'd be like playing a golf tournament. You play 72 holes, and you finish the golf tournament, and you go, oh, gosh, it's a tie. So I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to have a putting contest to decide who wins.
Yeah, they kind of were off.
If soccer wants to be a real sport, it has to play soccer to the end. It can't stop and say, okay, now we're going to do a skills challenge right at the end to decide who wins. I just think that's, if you're going to be a real sport, you got to have one, a clock you can trust, not a clock where people run out and say, we're adding 2 minutes.
I think on the planetary look at this, you're really on the short end.
Oh, I am.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, your perspective, I think, on this one is just off.
Oh, you think a skills challenge is the way to end a world championship in soccer? Football for the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think penalty kicks is part of the game I grew up with. That's not like a new little novel thought. Let's have a putt off. No,
or chip off. You know, we're gonna chip 10 golf balls and the closest one wins.
Dude, golf is like really sleepy.
No, golf's great. The British Open was a marvelous watch. Anyway, back to I couldn't resist throwing it in the soccer thing. That's what, gee whiz, what an unsatisfying ending.
Oh, dude, no, that was a marvelous watch. We had an absolute blast. We felt really bad, but then we kind of all just went, well, you know, Japan's had a hard time, so if someone got to lose to somebody, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried about the outcome, but I'm just thinking, gosh, I would much rather have had a sudden death just keep playing until somebody kicks it in the goal.
They did play a whole extra 30 minutes.
It wasn't sudden death. Because you score, and it's like, okay, maybe you win, maybe you don't.
You're just thinking with a football helmet, dude.
What? Football helmet?
They play sudden death.
Well, they do in football, but no, they just, I'm gonna have to grow a bit too.
You are. You don't quite get it yet.
World class.
I'm praying for you.
I'm just not gonna watch again until there's another World Cup.
Okay.
That will do it for me. Amy wrote this, The Place of Purpose, which we recorded probably 200 years ago now. Something
the like Place that. Of Purpose. That was a podcast we did?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
3 or 4 weeks ago now.
Okay.
So we've got a lot in the can, but it said this, I've been performance-driven to make God happy. I've been purpose-driven by people's agendas to make everything bigger and better. I've been personally driven to make sense of my life, yet I never found rest until I knew that He loves me. I'm still learning that I'm valued by Him and I don't have to do anything for it. It takes so long to debunk the old stuff. I want to be content in any and every situation and find my satisfaction in Him alone. And then she quotes C.S. Lewis, "We are half-hearted creatures fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." That's a great quote.
Yeah. I'm wondering what. I don't know that I'm far too easily pleased. I get that.
No, I think it's talking in general about people who don't have a sense of who they are or what they're doing.
Yeah, but I think there's more discontent than there is wonderful content. As far as the idea that people are far too easily pleased. I mean, I get it. I think there is a search in a lot of people that leads to a restlessness, not to a place of rest and peace. So I think even the folks who are doing mud pies in the shantylands, it's sort of like that's the best they know, and they're trying. They don't know what a holiday is at the beach or how to get there. You know, even when you say, you know, they're drinking and having sex, but they don't know what undescribable joy is right there. I think a lot of people, they don't know how to connect to the invisible in terms of the whole dynamics of the person presence of God.
Yeah, but I think part of that is what they are amused with gets in the way of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they get lost in the amusements of the flesh. And that was some radio thing on yesterday about some big drunken party they had out in some river here in Northern California, and they had to bust it with cops and everything. And here was people's great time of a good weekend. Go to an island with 6,000 people, get drunk out of your mind, and scream and yell and throw rocks at cop cars. I'm just going, wow, that is so not a holiday that strikes.
I had something better to do with my weekend.
Oh, absolutely. So I do think sometimes we get lost in stuff, and that is part of us not finding our way to the beach. Because I don't think this is just talking about literal people who are stuck in shanty towns who can't get to the beach. There's people who can get to the beach, but for whatever reason, just would be amused more with making mud pies than having something much more real and endearing in their hearts. And unfortunately, that happens too.
Do you find it the whole driven side of life, when people are trying to disconnect from that? I find that a lot of people end up in a place of going like, I don't know what to give myself to. It's like they've been so given one way, and then they're trying to sort of detox from that, and then they're not exactly sure how to re-engage.
Yeah, and I think that's where the whole instant gratification thing comes in to really haunt people, because when you're decompressing from the one world, or like you're decompressing from the religious world, and you're like not the whole inner life thing hasn't really connected yet, and you haven't sorted out how loved you are and learning to live in that rest and that love and that joy, I do think there's a period where it just, oh gosh, that old life seems better because this just seemed empty and alone. And so I'm going to run back to that. It's the children of Israel. Well, gosh, at least we had meals while we were in slavery, and it wasn't the same stupid manna every day we're picking up off the ground. So they're always coveting Egypt because they can't yet see the promised land. Even when they saw the promised land, they were going, okay, why did we come out here to be killed? We're just like grasshoppers. So even when they saw it, it seemed unattainable to them. And that's probably what you're talking about. People for whom real joy, real rest, real love seems unattainable. And therefore, I think you do just want to medicate your pain in whatever bondage you were in before. At least it had some amusement level and some, I think it's hard to live in that hallway in between where you're going, gosh, neither do I have that. I have this promise of maybe something wonderful over here, but I have no sense of it. And I have no way to find myself there. And so how long can you hold out hope in a world where you can't see the result yet is the challenge, I think, for anybody who goes on this journey. Because that time for me was incredibly painful. I don't know about you, but I'm like, I know this old thing. I'm not satisfied with. Can I make it work? Yes. Could I go back and just make a living at it? Yes. Do I know what this other thing is out here? No. I have no idea what that is. I just have this inner thing in my heart that says I have something better for you. And for a long time, it didn't seem better. So I think it's hard to hold on to that going, okay, it's going to be. And unless God invites us there, and unless there's something in our heart stronger than our own desire to be amused or be comfortable or be medicated or whatever, I think it's a tough way to find it. I really do.
Yeah, I think I've recognized, I guess what I'm sort of dancing around is, you know, when you try to understand what is it that motivates people to do what they do and how do they end up finding themselves in step with God in that? Because I don't think God is the slave driver driven, like, come on, let's go, you know, rah, yeah. I mean, I think religion and that sense of insecurity about my being at peace, like, am I okay? Am I valid? I think that's what really leaves people susceptible to that treadmill. And that's really hard. And then when they finally like learn to get off it, then they're a bit disoriented in terms of going like, well, I'm used to being driven by impulses in order to validate. Now that I've gotten quiet, I don't know that I'm any more validated. I'm trying to reorient. And it's sort of like I've found that God is sort of like, you know, he provides opportunities. I don't know that they're all him or not, but I can see that, you know, some of them are opportunities. I think what's been sliced off of me is the need to control the outcomes, which is really nice because that doesn't validate me.
Yeah.
But to be able to sort of respond to those moments of, Lord, would you have me do this? It's the idea of the I get to as opposed to I have to. That's been a real nice distinction.
Yeah.
But I think for a lot of people, there's still a sense of disorientation because it's almost as if there's the expectation that God is going to be chirping over here, go left, turn right, and you're just going like, that's not my experience with him at all. And so you're just going like, well, how do I sort that? How do I sort of relax into a rhythm of life with him where I'm responding to his, you know, kind of his nudges, but I'm not living in the insecurity of having to perform for him?
Yeah. And I think part of, for me, that journey lies in sorting out just how loved I am, even if I don't do anything for him. I think that, particularly part of being, whether it's the friends that you indulge the flesh with who now don't invalidate you when you're just going, you know, getting drunk all weekend just isn't my deal. Or the religious crowd and you were, you know, jumping through hoops there and getting a lot of strokes and getting a lot of validation. Now that crowd's looking at you like, well, you're not, you're not doing anything that you used to be doing. Again, the same dynamic is there. And until we sort out that maybe the most important purpose in all of this is that God just wants you to know his love and then to live in love toward other people. And as you learn to negotiate that reality of being loved and then caring about loving the people around you, I think the doors do swing. I think there's lots of opportunities to affect life and whatever in wonderful ways. There's opportunities to be fruitful. But I don't know that it's, I don't know if the drive to be fruitful is helpful. You know, even when Jesus.
No, I think the demand inside typically is it's to satisfy some kind of insecurity there.
Absolutely.
And it's really hard to quiet that down. If God doesn't conquer that with quieting me in his love, that's a loud voice for a lot of people. That really does create a tyranny of I had best do this, I better do this. And I think for a lot of people, it's hard to sort through what are the impulses that would be on the ledger of God and what are those loud screaming other impulses and how do I quiet them down? I mean, I think for a lot of people, that's a big challenge.
Oh, it's brutally hard. If you quieting down and nothing, I've said to people, hey, if nothing happens for 2 years, just relax. And people go, you
I think people lose
mind.
Their full mind.
Oh, gosh. The attention span of a person on that kind of journey is about 20 seconds. And I've been quiet for 20 seconds.
What do I do now?
Why isn't God
what do
speaking?
I do now?
And it almost never takes 2 years. It just almost doesn't. But until you relax, even if it's the rest of my life. And people, what? No, I just got in my mind. And if you do, then you're still being driven by something. And I'm one of the most driven guys I used to know. You know, I was incredibly driven into my early 40s to accomplish great things for God and be one of God's special whatever and find significance in publishing and all kinds of things. And I lost that about 18 years ago. And it's...
Why?
It's not a bad guy to lose. It's the guy in the car, he's naggy, naggy, complaining. It's great to lose that voice.
How did you lose that?
Died. Died a 2-year death to my reputation, to lies about me, to whatever ministry I thought was valuable for God. All that went away for a 2-year period, and it was just painful.
And that was forced on you.
Well, I don't know that I could say that. It was the result of some choices I made.
Okay.
So I don't say it was forced on me, because I made choices that kind of put me there, and right. I made choices not to leave there until something bigger happened. So I don't feel like a victim. I look back now going, gosh, what a graceful years. And as somebody said, those are great days to have behind you. I wouldn't want to go, I wouldn't want to go that terrifying. I mean, waking up every morning with a pain in the gut of your stomach, just regretting even waking up and what the day holds and what else you're going to hear and what else is going to go wrong today. 2 years of that. And the first thing you can think of every day is the person that's most betrayed you and lied about you. That's
that's not a good morning.
That's not a good day. But, you know, there were ways to jump out of that. There were ways that other things came my way that I would say, you know what, I can just move beyond this, or I can do this to fight back. And I think I look back and say, gosh, some of the choices I made, which I would even say are grace-based choices. I even look at some of those decisions today going, wow, I can't believe I made that decision. I really can't. I can't believe I didn't follow through with what my head wanted to do and instead found a way to connect with my heart. But I was so reduced to nothing. I mean, I'd lost all my moorings that the only thing I could really wake up and do every day is, God, I just want to please you. And the invitation I kept hearing was just keep following. Just this will pass. This too will pass.
When you say you lost all your moorings, is it the things that used to define and give you value?
Yeah, partly that.
Because I think one of the exchanges I think is people are sort of busy trying to affirm that. You know, how do I demonstrate that that's in fact what I got? When what displaces that, when all of a sudden I realize that I am loved and I don't have to perform for that, that's what changes the sort of the little tide inside. You know, I get a flow with God as opposed to flowing against the whole bit of how do I prove my worth. I think for a lot of people, the challenge is if that's not defined internally in a secure way, that's what makes you susceptible to being driven all over the place.
Yes, absolutely.
When that gets defined inside, that's what allows for a sense of peace and a different form of I don't have to, I get to. And that's what, for a lot of people, when they're trying to disconnect from what they know is not working, kind of in the whole religious mindset, until that's happened, it's really hard to sit still.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like what you said about being defined inside, because that isn't just, I mean, you know, people listen to this, and I know we're so principled thinking people by the way that our religious culture has shaped us that we're going, okay, I just need to be comfortable with what God thinks of me, and I'm going to play a mental gymnastic to find that place. And
that doesn't work.
It's a reality that becomes real in your heart, and I do think that's won over great seasons, even 2 years, of learning to live inside the Father's love and letting some things die, because I don't think we're smart enough just to make a mental change. I love the word you use, defined inside. I mean, there's something inside here that changes where no longer is my reputation important, no longer is my significance at issue, no longer is me, 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 daddy, me, me, me. I've found that place that I'm loved, and he invites me to be part of a journey with him, and that's all about getting to, not having to. But I think that's so wonderfully defined inside of him. And I don't think we make that happen. I think we can be open to the process and either cooperate with the process, which means letting some things die. To me, the cooperating with the process isn't, I'm just going to grab one good thing after another. It does involve letting some things die that I don't want to die. They're little comfort, you know, little comfort things like your security blanket and your, you know, your this, but I can't, I am capable of doing a lot of stuff here. So what, I can't do that stuff now? What, I can't just make it happen by the sheer grit of my teeth? And so I do think we're cooperative in that process, but again, it's an inner reality that's not, you can't just principle it into your life and say, oh, I'm going to make myself believe that now.
Well, I think the big danger is I can define that for me. I just don't think that that's helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, that it's like I have the capacity to go, okay, so I can drive myself, I can define myself, I can give myself a purpose and give myself a reason to get up. It's just the I dynamic of that, that's where I kind of run out of gas. Until that gets defined by God, where I'm going like, I didn't define that for myself. I didn't just fill in the silence with my more of my words.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest difficulty is when you're anxious and you've been living a driven life because of that anxiety, to then all of a sudden be quiet and wait for his voice to come and define that. That's really hard.
Yeah, and not whether it's words we try to lose it in, or I think busyness is the way we really, the more insecure I feel, the busier I'll make myself to do something, teach something, write something. Yeah, I got to do something. And I see that harried thing. And you know, in the normal traditional congregation, we call that person fruitful. Because they're busy and working hard. And, you know, we sometimes used, I look back and go, gosh, I can't believe the pain of people that we used to motivate them to the things we needed done to survive as an institution. And we just fed that. And we even acclaimed that. People who were overly busy and working hard. And that's the model. We want everybody to be like that person. And it turns out that person is withering inside in all that busyness. But we didn't know it until too late.
Well, I looked at the whole bit of, I know how some of this transition began for me. I really felt this invitation to, quote, be still and know that I am God. Well, for a doer, that just didn't compute. You know, it's like The whole idea of be still, I translated into do nothing, which is a totally different command.
Do nothing.
It's like, I don't know how to do nothing, but doing nothing is not the same as being still. And I equated the two, and I got confused by my equation because doing nothing felt empty and without value. Being still is a whole different positive approach to inactivity that embraces a sense of I. And what I finally realized is, guess what? The reason I'm asking you to be still is because you can't do this. It's not that you can't do a whole bunch of things. I can do a whole bunch of things. That's my biggest problem.
Yeah.
It's that I can't satisfy that thing inside. I can't define that thing inside for me. That really does have to be done by God. And the beauty of when it finally is that really was sort of one of the first defining points of recognizing the difference between what I do and the reality that there is a supernatural being called God who is doing something that's not me. And once I started to see that, that's where that sense of the dialogue in relationship with him really took on life, where I'm going like, you love me, you're doing this, not me performing for you and then grading my own test.
Yeah.
And I think just a lot of people, it's like, gosh, that moment, I can't do God's part in my life. I can be available to it. And I can discern it and receive it, but I can't make it happen. And that's just a scary place for a lot of people to try to wait.
Yeah, it is. And I read something this week. Actually, a friend sent it to me. I've been reading the history of the popes that we talked about a couple weeks ago. I'm still in the Reformation now, kind of reading through all that. But a friend of mine who's been studying the atonement, and he's reading a book, Alistair McGrath's book, I Used to Teach Today.
What?
I know it's Latin. I don't know. I didn't.
I used to teach today. I did too.
Used to teach today. I don't even know how to say this. Anyway, we'll put a link so you can see it on the podcast. But he was he's talking about, this was originally written in 1986. It's a heavy theological book. But he sent me some quotes from it because he said, Wesley, or the Pietist movement, made five modifications to the Orthodox doctrine of justification, which added to all this angst that we have now to somehow earn our relationship with God and earn our fruitfulness with Him. And it was a reaction to, because here in the church of the day, which was the Roman Catholic Church up till the 1500s for any of us in the West, they had this, you know, doctrine of grace and atonement that was, you know, you're imputed righteousness by the work of Christ, and that's all good. But they had a hard time motivating people then to be righteous in the world. So they came up with this purgatory indulgence thing. So if you're going to be bad, you at least have to pay us to build our buildings out of your bad stuff. So they came up with this whole thing. Well, the Pietist movement, Wesley was kind of the bigger one. And when he's talking about Wesley, I'm going, don't ding with Wesley, because I've got some wonderful Wesley books on my shelf. Not books he wrote, but books about him that I found very engaging back when I was a pastor. And then he started reading these five characteristics to me, and I went, oh my gosh, is that where I picked this up? Because I haven't read Wesley since I left the pastorate. I haven't had the need to motivate people to be better than they want to be since that. But the Pietist movement was all about, it changed the nature of atonement, because they just, well, being baptized as a baby doesn't guarantee you nothing, and you die when you got to live in a way that honors God. And so here's the five modifications they made. One, faith is to be understood as active rather than passive in justification. In other words, not just I believe what Christ did, but I have to believe, and by believing, I make it real for me.
Is that what they is that what they mean by that? Whereas a passive is just I receive and accept something? It's that I've got to do something?
Yeah, if it's going to be active. In other words, without your active faith, justification doesn't happen for you.
Okay.
So it turned that into, again, and I read this in, you know, when I was a kid growing up, even older, in 20s, maybe 30s, the whole thing of being a radical Christian, you know, because we're more committed, more devoted, working hard. Blah, that's all from that Pietist
thing.
Cutting
edge. I got to be there.
Yeah, it all comes from that. It's a reaction to people who just, you know, well, they believe
sitting on their rusty dusty.
They imputed grace, and so now they don't do anything. So now we're going to put a whole lot of to-dos alongside grace. And so the intense emphasis placed by Pietism upon the necessity of personal piety led to the articulation of the doctrine of Christian perfection, a concept without any counterpart within, indeed, which was excluded by Orthodoxy. So the whole idea of that we have to be perfect to make God happy.
Be ye perfect as I am perfect.
Yeah, as a lifetime dream as God shaping it, not as a reality you can pull off today. I think the Pietist said we can pull it off today. And we've got to really be disciplined enough. And Wesley's whole, you know, organized those class meetings. The class meetings revolved around five questions. You know, what have I done to fail God last week? What am I going to do this week to make sure I don't fail Him? It was all...
What?
Yeah, it was all based on performance.
I'm really glad I missed that class.
Yeah, I guess so. Then the concept of vicarious satisfaction is rejected as detrimental to personal piety. The criticism is particularly associated with John Wesley. To Wesley, the assertion that Christ had fulfilled the law on behalf of humanity appeared to imply that humans were no longer under obligation to it. And he wanted people to be obligated. The whole idea of obligation was critical. So they had to change. And I'm going, gosh, is that how the religious treadmill got built in Western society? Because whether it's Wesley or the Anabaptists or whomever, there was all a strain of thought which became far more works-oriented because of the problem. And here, I guess here's the precipice we're trying to not walk on. Maybe this is the narrow road Jesus is defining. Live in grace and love and be transformed just the way we were talking about. One side off that cliff is, well, hey, God's already made me righteous. Doesn't matter how I live. I just do whatever I want. Nobody cares anymore. Blah, 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 and I live like hell. Or the other side of that is, I'm going to balance myself against those licentious people, and I'm going to become pietist, which sounds better than legalist, but it's the same thing. I'm going to go on a performance thing to make me better than you. And whether it's radical Christian or revolutionaries, I think it still appeals to what we talked about this whole podcast, which is my validation. I'm better than you because I'm doing, and this narrow road seems to be, the precipice seems to be, I'm going to live in love with God, and I'm going to let Him change me. And I'm going to embrace His priorities, not as an act of piety to earn anything, but just as a gift that God invites me into to live His life. And there's something between those two extremes, the licentious, do whatever you want, doesn't matter, to the legalist, I've got to perform to make God happy. There's a way that God's already loves me, and I can live in that love, and that love actually changes me.
Well, I think it's either resting in or responding to His voice, or you're going to make the big mistake of trying to either fill it in like, well, I'm fine, I don't have to do anything, or, you know, I better do this. And it's kind of like, gosh, if God is not the voice that's affirming you, I don't want to be the one that's trying to affirm me. I know I'll exhaust me. And I think that's the whole revolutionary side. The even worrying about the folks sitting on the couch not doing nothing, that seems to be kind of like, well, what's that to you? Why do you got to get them up?
Because misery loves company.
but that seems to be the religious impulse. I know that longer a pastor, guess what? I no longer feel like that's part of my job description. I'm not one of the sheepdogs needing to bark at the sheep, trying to get the sheep over where?
Wasn't that one of the pressures, though? I remember back in the day of religious leadership almost always throughout history is, how do I help these stupid people who aren't listening to Jesus not have to listen to Jesus?
It's just sort of a fundamental wrong assumption about them to go about doing that.
It is, but you've got to say, okay, now, even down to we couldn't even trust the leadership, so we're going to prepare for them a list of readings and homilies and things to read for the whole church year, because we don't trust that people can listen to Jesus and help others follow him. And the way we do, if you're not listening to him and he's not changing you, well, let me tell you the things he would be saying to you if you were listening, and here are the things you should be doing. And I think religious leadership has made that mistake for 2,000 years, if not 6,000 years. It always falls on the side of, I need to get you to act in a certain way, whether it's money to build my cathedral, whether it's acting righteous so that our church looks better than any other church in this community. And it's that quest to be the best or in with the right group, or whenever these revival things break out, this is the last, best, greatest thing God's doing on the planet. It's all appealing to that same thing in us. And it also flies in the face of, no, you get to have that voice in your life. If you don't have that voice in your life, stop everything else and let God begin to teach you how to listen to that voice. Not, well, if you can't hear that voice, well, here's the 23 things he would be telling you to do if you were listening, and you can do them for me instead of doing them.
See, that book should be banned. The 23 things that if you didn't hear that you should be doing.
Yeah, it should be. I agree.
I think that's what gets us into so much trouble, because they sound right. They just may not be right for me or for right now.
Yeah. What's bad in the Pietist movement? What's bad about personal holiness? You say that and people go, wow, that's got to be right. Well, what does personal holiness look like? Well, it looks like these 23 things.
But you know what's bad about it? Trying to do it without him. That's really bad. Because it'll never get there. It'll really make you upset. And it really is what leads to a whole bunch of those rusty dusties are not moving and doing. And you just end up with all this religious comparison and judgment. And you get lost in the weeds.
Which is the point of Galatians. That's exactly the point. You cannot, even if you had all the right 23 things, doing them without him is impossible. And doing them without him wouldn't be fruitful.
And it ain't no fun.
What's worse, it really sucks. Yeah. Which is, again, Paul's point in Galatians. I agree. But I was amazed reading this going back. Here's a guy I've read stuff about, and I really liked it because it really was the attempt to manipulate people to act better, but I didn't see it back in the day when I was actively wanting or thinking my job was to help people act better. Yeah. And now you go, okay, so all this whole pie, which appeals to, I'm wanting to be the radical Christian, I want to be the revolutionaries, I want to be on the cutting edge of what God's doing. And then that appeals to something so religiously fleshy in us. I mean, it looks godly. That's the deception of it. It looks so pick and godly. I want to be a radical believer for Jesus. And you don't realize that that's already drawing me into space that's going to make me have to perform in ways I can't. And then I'm going to have substitutes for the God who wants to know me. And I do think we need to keep encouraging people. A lot of what I do for people is I sit around them in the middle of them going, nothing's working, it's not happening, nothing's going, and I hate the Bible. And I sit there and say, you know what? You'll get through this. Just keep loving God. He's big and not, well, you got to stop talking that way. You got to read your Bible. So you know what? You'll come to know him. Just keep here. Keep on this journey, because it's the only thing that changes, folks, as I see it.
Yeah, as I see it. I think that the biggest challenge is, I'm just thinking, how many people are now going to try to have some conversation with a radical revolutionary that's trying to motivate them and everyone else? And I'm just going, like, that is just one of the conversations not to have.
With them?
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say, avoid a whole bunch of trouble, because they're not in a frame of mind where they're going to be able to hear you.
But I'm just sure they're going to love this as much as I love it.
No. See, I think that's the mistake they have, because whatever is motivating them, they're wanting to get everyone else on their deal.
Yeah.
And then when all of a sudden you get off that deal, you sort of feel like, I got to pull everyone else that is on that deal off. And I'm just going, like, neither of those are all that helpful. I think the thing I've recognized that has been so freeing is, it's not my job to make you do anything.
Yeah, and once I start doing that, I move outside the context of love. It's not even God's heart to make us do something. But religion is always about applying the pressure to make us do what's right. And even God doesn't apply that pressure to our life. The calling to live in God is an invitation. It can't be done by threat. It can't be done by compulsion. It's got to be.
And it can't be done without him.
It's got to be willingly chosen to engage the relationship. And yeah, be transformed with him. That's the only way this works.
Yeah, the whole be ye perfect as I am perfect, that's not something you can do without him.
Nor would want to try. Absolutely.
No, I know, yeah. But yeah. I don't think we hear that the life that we're meant to lead is a with him life. I can't do it without him. So if you don't have him, and you kind of like, well, do you have? I mean, I have no desire to try to convince someone that is feeling like, well, I don't have God in my life. I'm not trying to convince them that they do. I want to say, okay, well, then the one thing let's not do is try to do something. If somehow you're not sensing where he's at or what he's doing, my attitude is, danger. Sit down right now. Don't go anywhere. Don't do anything. Ask him to come find you and wait.
Yeah. And it's not God. And when you say wait, I don't think it's God saying, you know what? Just wait, because about January 15th, 2013, I'm going to show up and help you. I think what it is when we quiet our hearts down, that quieting takes months and years to help, sometimes to drive out all the other voices that prey on us and even pretend to be God for us. It's not waiting because he's inactive. It's waiting because lots of stuff that makes me busy, makes me perform, makes me try to please people around me, untangling that mass takes time for God. And so it's not an inactive waiting. It's a very active, I'm going to transform you. Relax enough until that reality begins to emerge instead of trying to perform it on your own.
But the anxiety of that waiting, God is not around the corner looking to see how serious you are or looking to see how much you want it. I mean, those right, voices absolutely. Are absolutely terrible, yeah. And they're very deceptive. And it's kind of like I've heard people toss that stuff out. It's like, well, you know, God knows if you just really want this or not. It's like, you know what? Yeah, I'm sure he does. I don't. And I think that's the whole bit of, I didn't know how important it was to learn to be still and how challenging it is to embrace that. Because all the other forms and the ways I used to get my validation are screaming at me that I'm invalid unless I can prove. And you think of the whole temptations where, you know, the devil comes to Jesus. It's always, if you are, if you are, if you are. And it's like, well, you know what? I just am.
I just am.
I'm not going to prove it to me. I'm not going to prove it to the devil. I'm not going to prove it to you. God has to win that in me. And that is just a missing piece I can't do without him.
And I think that's where love invites us to trust him enough to do it. I love you enough, Wayne, that I even through this season that you think everything is going wrong and everything's forsaken you, I'll get you through this. And he does. And it becomes so transforming in the end. And that's what we're inviting people to. It's not just sit on your couch and do nothing. It's learn to be still and know that he's God. And then you'll know how to live your life in a way that's not all driven by all the crud the world drives us by. Hey, before we go, I want to just mention the Kenya folks. I don't know how aware people are in this podcast of the incredible drought that's been in that area this spring and the food costs. And everything for our brothers and sisters in Kenya is far worse than it was 6 months ago.
Oh, gosh.
So they are needing some funds and resources and help feed the kids in the orphanage we helped put together, as well as now help some of the widows from the tribal violence find ways to make a living. They've got some ideas about that. It's going to take some income they don't have. So people want to send that to us, we're happy to pass it on to them.
On the God Journey, you can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.